First of all, I want to thank Zeifman's for hosting this wonderful event and giving us a venue for the class and providing a delectable lunch, which I hope to partake of after the lecture. I guess going back to last week, I wouldn't want to be cheating my job of eating while giving the lecture. I want to devote my entire attention to the task at hand. So just a quick, brief announcement, a request to turn off cell phones or put them to silence so that the lecture isn't interrupted. So the topic of today's class is the ethics of firing a client. The question we will discuss is what considerations to consider before terminating a relationship with one's clients in a business setting. So before we delve into the sources, I'd like to actually pose this question to the audience. I'm sure many of you have experience with many different types of clients. What type of considerations would you factor into your decision making before terminating a client? And what would drive a professional to terminate a relationship with a client? Yes?
Criminal action.
If the client is involved in criminal action. Okay, fair. I think that qualifies as a good reason too.
Right.
No, can't argue with that. Anything else?
Someone who's negligent.
A client that's negligent. Fair. Not quite criminal, but negligent. I think that's fair.
Are we allowed to say they're not paying their fees?
Not paying their fees, also fair. So these are all examples where the client... I have got a list. We'll get to it.
You take that list and you can interpret it so many ways that means that you can fire a client whenever you want.
So I actually thought differently, but what would you say? Do you think you should be able to fire a client?
I don't have to think. If you want to do it, you can do it, because these particular lists that you've given us here can be interpreted in such a way that it can work.
Okay.
Having been in practice for over 40 years, I tell you that's the case.
You can. But I'm also asking, not only can you, but is it the right thing to do?
Look, if you don't like working with somebody at any rate, other than if you have other partners, maybe you try to, suggest maybe using some other partner in your firm, but if you don't want to work with that particular client, then...
Was your first name? I'm sorry.
Nathan.
So Nathan is, I think Nathan is giving a fundamentally different suggestion here than the first two responses, which were the client has to do something wrong, either criminal or negligent, before you go into the decision-making process of terminating that relationship. Nathan is suggesting that you just don't like working with them, period. Is that's a completely different type of suggestion. Maybe another question to throw out before we look at these sources. What considerations would you take into account which would make you think twice about terminating a client? Why would you not be reluctant to do so? Yes?
Well, just wouldn't it be the same considerations you would take to take on a client if you wouldn't have taken them on, and now with all this more information, you go, I never would have taken them on had I known this.
There are more sheets in the corner.
That's
a good point, but my counterpoint would be, now you have taken them on, and what significance does that decision to start a relationship with clients have? Yes.
If it becomes public, then other clients may wonder, why did this happen? If there wasn't a clear public reason why, and it wasn't mutually agreeable. In other words, if the client suffered some distress from that, and they might mention it, it's called a net promoter score. How many people would say, had such a good experience they'd refer another potential client, versus how many would say never do business with them?
Saying it's bad for you, because it might
be bad for the business, it could be bad for your partners.
Right. Okay, so I just want to take a look at the first source, which I wanted you to reference. Let's hear your suggestion.
So if you're a nonprofit, at your AGM, you elect your auditor, and it might be complicated for that nonprofit to replace you unless there's a...
And why is that the auditor's problem?
Usually they agree to do it before, so there might be some kind of a binding contract.
Okay, so the question is, when are contracts binding? And with auditors, I think I want to get to one other additional factor. Yes?
One other issue. I basically work with the legal field. The legal field would be the same applicable dispute. What, if the client owes money, is he responsible to pay the bills? And in my opinion, if I were to fight a case, it's very simple. Unless you have a legitimate reason, which is accepted by law and accepted by the general public, you cannot charge that client what you owe. If you dismiss them, it's your problem. Now, if there's a legitimate reason, then you have a right to go to the client and ask whatever he owes you. A big difference, and that's a major thing if you try to dismiss a client.
Right. So you're suggesting, what if I already have done work for the client that I'd expect it to be paid for?
That is the problem.
And when they may have the right to decide not to pay me. The question would be, well, what if I decide that it's worth it?
Okay, that's something else. But I'm saying, if you want to collect the amount that's owed in law society, there are particular rules in legal to collect from a client.
Fair.
I don't know what applies to that account.
Fair.
But in many cases, they'll owe you money still.
Fair. Okay.
In the auditing profession, you're not the only show in town. It's so easy to find another auditor who would desperately possibly want the business. It's not like if you're in a situation like a small town, you're the only accountant. It may be very different to leave someone.
Okay. Okay, so I want to address a lot of these points. So I'll just look at these first two sources, and then from a halachic standpoint as well. And we can continue this discussion. So if you look at the first source, what strikes me about it, this is from the CPA journal, something I found in my research. What strikes me about it is that the focus is on the CPAs. Like, those are the considerations we're thinking about. Is it appropriate for you? Is it beneficial for the CPA firm? And this is particularly in the field of tax. Will it harm you if you sever the relationship? So it says as follows. Client termination creates the most difficulty for CPA firms and has historically caused significant professional liability exposure. Once the decision is made to terminate the professional relationship, the CPA is no longer in charge of the engagement. Clients often feel a sense of disloyalty and begin to point fingers. The client might even allege breach of contract if the CPA terminated the relationship prematurely. CPAs should exercise caution in any 11th hour termination and seek assistance from their professional liability carriers or legal counsel. So again, when looking at this paragraph, who are we worried about when the CPA terminates a relationship? Which party are we worried about? The CPA. It's going to be bad for you. There might be a lawsuit. You might be liable. It hasn't worked well in the past. That's what we were thinking about. It was interesting to me seeing this, and we'll see if this is the same from a law perspective. Do you have to worry about the client? Terminating a client relationship, there may have been an expectation that you would have continued to do work for them, and they might have been relying on you to do that work, and what does severing the relationship leave them with? And even more forcefully, you may have made a commitment. You may not have the right to terminate that relationship. Yes?
What if you pass your client on to someone just as equally competent as yourself? So you're not leaving him hanging there.
So that's a way of sort of addressing this problem. They might still claim, well, there's a reason that you were my CPA and not them. Meaning it's nice that you want to help me out, and it might be, and truth is, halakhically, we'll see that does play into consideration, but you committed to them, not the other CPA firm. And that's something yeah.
Pardon my lack of knowledge, what does it mean, what is the
expression,
11th hour termination?
At the very end of a particular engagement, last minute.
Okay.
Yeah. So on the one hand, this is again in tax engagement specifically, the emphasis seems to be on how can you make sure that you don't get injured from this severance of the relationship. However, if you look for the reasons for terminating a client, it seems to me they do seem to be pretty extreme. Or if not extreme, it certainly seems to be a case where it's the client that is not performing or is really inconveniencing you. So it says conflicts of interest, where it's, you know, unethical to continue working with the client, unethical behavior by the client, refusal to adhere to the tax preparer's advice, repeated non-payment of professional fees, they're not paying you on time, incomplete mess, you're lacking records, they're making it difficult for you to do your job, continuous disrespect of the staff and the partners, engagements outside the CPA's or firm's comfort level. You're uncomfortable for some reason with the type of engagement you have been involved with, and frequent last-minute demands for services. Now, not all of these are legal or criminal, but they all do point to a certain lack of cooperation by the client. Well, there might be another reason you might not want to work for a client, which is you just don't like them, one. Or two, what if you discover another opportunity for a more financially beneficial relationship? What if I find another big-time client who's willing to pay me double the amount that the first client is paying? Right? The CPA firm is not discussing that. It doesn't discuss, well, if you find a better business opportunity, then also you might consider terminating the client relationship. I find that interesting. What do we think about simply terminating the client relationship, not because they're doing anything wrong, but because I have a better opportunity elsewhere? Any thoughts before we discuss that?
I don't feel I'm beholden to...
Not legitimate grounds.
Why not? I'm not beholden to a client.
Okay.
It's a mutual agreement for service.
Before anything happens,
I don't want to continue this relationship because I found a more lucrative opportunity. Why not?
Okay. So I think the question is, when are you beholden to, or are you ever beholden to, a client to finish that relationship? Now, I want a contract, and when is a contract binding, both legally and halachically? There is an interesting distinction that you see between auditors and tax professionals. Would anyone be willing to suggest why there might be a difference?
Yeah, different level of risk with tax professionals versus audits.
In the sense that?
Tax professionals tend to have to do a little more aggressive type of planning.
Okay.
It might be under the radar.
All right.
With an audit, you're not necessarily serving the client. You're serving the people relying on the financials, which are... Yes.
So, exactly. So we see, and we'll see in source number two, there. When we think about severing a relationship with a client, another consideration is, what is the nature of the service that you are providing, and which parties are you beholden to? Meaning there might be certain relationships which are contingent upon them being mutually beneficial. You're providing a service, you gain and they gain, and that's one type of relationship. But sometimes you're not just providing a service, you're doing a public duty. You are helping out the public. For instance, in the case of auditors, the reason for auditing the financial statements isn't simply to provide the company with the service, it's so that the investors and other users of their financial statements are properly informed as to whether or not they're accurate, and that levies a greater degree of responsibility upon auditors. If you take a look at source number two, and this is from the Ontario CPA Code of Professional Conduct, it says as follows, as a general rule, the proper course for an appointed auditor to follow is the completion of the auditor's statutory duties having been appointed by the shareholders. The auditor has a duty to them and should report as required in the legislation. The auditor should cease to act on behalf of a client only after a successor has been properly appointed and the auditor has been relieved or disqualified. The auditor should never lightly resign an appointment before reporting and should not resign at all before reporting if there is a reason to suspect that the auditor's resignation is required by reason of any impropriety or concealment upon which it is the auditor's duty to report. Notice the difference here. Whereas regard to tax professionals, if they are doing something illegal or criminal, it's encouraged to sever the relationship. In regard to an auditor, since your job is specifically to report on the illegal nature of their activity, it is highly discouraged at that point from severing the client relationship. Subject to that general statement, however, there may be exceptional circumstances in a particular case which would justify the auditor's resignation. This will be a matter of individual judgment in each case. So I think we see from this particular line here in the CPA Code of Professional Conduct, auditors have different considerations. It's not just, am I benefiting from this relationship or am I inconveniencing my client? It's what will happen if now the financial statements are issued and no one has ordered them properly. Maybe that will lead others to make mistakes that should have been avoided had I performed my professional duties. And I have an additional responsibility, not just to my client, but also to the public at large. So what I'd like to do for the continuation of the class is look at this from both a legal law perspective. When do I have the right to sever a relationship with a client, and what are the ramifications of doing so? So I think the first question to ask here is, when does it become binding? When does my relationship to an employee or to a client, where I'm the employee, to an employer, rather, when am I bound to fulfill my responsibilities? So take a look here, and I think this is essentially agreed upon in the literature. Verbal commitments in secular law are binding.
Not in account. The engagement letter is not signed. You are not responsible.
Interesting, because that's not...
The engagement letter lays out what the client's going to do and what you are going to do. So verbal contracting, auditing, as I've audited public companies, I tell you, it's not binding. The only time it's binding is when the engagement letter is signed. And in fact, you're not supposed to, and you're not allowed to issue an audit opinion without the engagement letter having been signed.
Okay. My question isn't only whether or not you should actually issue an engagement letter or issue an audited financial statement. My question also is, let's say you haven't yet, do you have any obligation to? You're arguing that that's not the case. My understanding is that a contract does require a serious consideration, that both parties have seriously come to the table and decided that they want to make a transaction with each other. There has to be an offer, and each party has to not be under duress and be in the situation where they can make a decision willingly. It was my understanding that oral contracts are generally legally binding, although it is certainly possible that in the realm of the field of auditing, that's not the case. Just if you take a look at your number here, number three, a contract can be either oral or written, provided the elements required to form a legally binding contract have been met.
I think that's just the legal field.
Yeah. My understanding was that I actually saw a case recently with not the legal field. It was just, I forgot which company it was, but that was my understanding. But be that as it may, certainly at the point when the contract has been signed, at that point, there is an actual commitment to the client. The question is, what is the case in Jewish law? So take a look at source number four. This is from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, for Yosef Karo. So it's actually pretty surprising. It says and we'll read these sources in English. Those who would like to read them in Hebrew are welcome to do so. It says, one who hires workers and they deceive the employer, or the employer deceives them. The deception here is they back out. So we have an employer and employees. They agree verbally to make a commitment to each other to perform a particular task. And at some point in this relationship, either the employer or employees back out, retract from the relationship, right? Without any particular cause given, they just decide they no longer want to fulfill their responsibilities. What is the penalty? Well, believe it or not, says the Shulchan Aruch, or Yosef Karo, all they have against each other are complaints. Now, we'll discuss a bit later what the nature of these complaints are. It means you could say, you know, my boss wasn't fair to me, and they laid me off without any notice. They backed out of the deal. But legally and monetarily, at this point, there is no penalty for backing out. The oral contract in Jewish law doesn't become binding until there is what we call a kinyan, an act of acquisition. Sometimes that merely constitutes the representative giving over of a handkerchief or something like that, that I give you something to represent the fact that we are now committed and beholden to each other. However, sometimes it can be with an actual signed contract that is given over. The verbal commitment in and of itself in Jewish law generally is not binding. If you take a look at source number five, this is Rabbi Moses Maimonides in his Mishnah Torah, his work on Jewish law. Hamekach eina nikne bidvarim. Purchases cannot be acquired with verbal agreements, even if witnesses testify about them. So says the Rambam, it is not just that by leaving your agreement without any writing, that you are making yourself vulnerable to denial later on in the relationship. It's not just that, how are you ever going to prove that there was a commitment? Even if you bring witnesses to the commitment and you say, we were there when the two parties agreed to perform the services for each other, it is still not binding. Because in Jewish law, verbal acquisitions are generally not financially binding until an act of acquisition is made. So for starters, in terms of thinking about the responsibilities one has to a client legally, it will only be binding financially if an act of acquisition is made, a formal act of either giving over of the handkerchief or signing a contract or the like. Now, generally, money exchanging hands is an interesting question. It's actually an interesting question. Money does not always constitute an act of acquisition in Judaism, believe it or not. Now, and there's also another complication, which we'll mention in a second, in regards to employment contracts specifically. But in a case of a sale, certainly, the sale of certain objects, money will be a form of legal act and will make the acquisition binding. But in certain cases, it does not. You need to do something else. Another act of acquisition, sometimes it's picking up the object, bringing it into your jurisdiction, and the like. Yes?
The mazel
of bracha. Okay, that's an interesting question. There's some of these acquisitions may be based on what's generally done in the profession. There's something called situmta in halacha, which means that if by doing a particular act, it's understood that we are committing to the acquisition, that does constitute a legally binding transaction, so that might fall into that category, perhaps a handshake. But just saying, yeah, okay, let's do it, doesn't always work. So if you take a prospective client out to the ball game or something like that, and you're having a discussion, even if you even agree to terms, essentially at that conversation, until the contract is signed or another act has been performed, you are not financially bound to that agreement. And therefore, the responsibility will certainly be much less, and maybe there is more grounds for backing out. Additionally, Judaism has a unique perspective toward employees generally. Meaning, although, of course, we should be thinking about the considerations of the client in any client relationship, there is a unique concern in Judaism for the welfare of workers and professionals performing work for their employers. Take a look at source number six. This is from the Gemara in Bava Metzia. Ooh, looks like I forgot to translate that one. I apologize for that. The Gemara in Bava Metzia says as follows. I'll just translate it from outside. Rav says, a worker can renege from a business relationship even in the middle of the day, even in the middle of a job. Why? It says, for the children of Israel are slaves to me. They are my slaves and not slaves to slaves. That, and based on this discussion in the Talmud, many commentaries suggest that we are afraid of the potential subservience an employee will have to an employer. That because of the fact that the employer has jurisdiction over the employee and jurisdiction over their time when they have to work, we don't want that employment relationship to be something akin to slavery. Now, you'll say, of course, you're getting paid for it, but the concern over the employee not having the freedom to make decisions with their own time and not having the freedom to decide when they want to do something and when they don't is a consideration the halacha takes very seriously. And therefore, if you look at source number 7, this is a more contemporary source from Yaakov Yeshaya Blau in his work Peche Choshen, but he is essentially summarizing some more classic sources. It says, one who hires a worker and the worker wants to retract from the relationship, he can retract even after he began working. So a worker generally has the right, beyond just the consideration of when does the contract become binding, generally, in halacha, in Jewish law, workers have more freedom than others. Workers have the freedom to retract from a relationship, even in the middle of a job, even if they have already began working for their employer. And it is the weighing of these two values. On the one hand, the concern for the employer, which we'll get to in a few minutes. But on the other hand, the concern for the freedom of the employee, that they should have the right, if they decide that it is no longer what they want to do with their time, they should have the right to back out of a relationship. Yes. Oh, because so that's what we'll get to. What if the relationship caused damages? Very good. We'll get to that in a few minutes.
In the middle of the job, whatever it is, and it just stops, it's causing damage to the...
Okay, so yes, that is a very important consideration. Yes?
But it looks like in Baba Metzia number 6, that the rabbi is only referring to employees who are Jewish, because it says in the Hebrew, ki li b'nei Yisrael avadim. So there's no reference to someone who's not Jewish. This is a reference to only Jewish employees.
Employees. That is. I think it is a good point you are making. It's very possible that this unique ability to quit in the middle of a job is particular to that unique status. However, I think it does point to the general concern that we have for employees, and you'll see that there is even beyond this particular law, there is a unique ability. What'd you say? I would argue that this is not simply something that is unfair if they can't otherwise. Again, the worker is literally stopping mid-job. It's a unique right that the halacha is affording to workers, that even after they've already committed and began a job, they have the right to back out. I wouldn't say that it's inappropriate to not give people that right. Now, I just want to, if you take a little bit further in source number 7, sorry, someone?
No, I said keep going.
Yeah, look at source number 7. We see that there is, in halacha, a distinction between types of workers. And I'm sure all of you are thinking, is it really fair to compare any type of worker nowadays to a slave? We have much more freedom nowadays. And that point is a valid one, as seen in the continuation of source number 7. It says, the sages only say that a worker can retract regarding someone hired for a period of time. However, if he hired him as a contractor to complete a particular task, once he begins working, he is unable to retract. If he does retract, we pay him for the work he has performed based on the calculation of what still must be completed, and the contractor, should say contractor, has the lower hand. So what this means is that there is a distinction in halacha, in Jewish law, between people who are regular hired employees, meaning they have hours that they must work, and they're paid based on their time that they put in, versus someone who is doing a particular task or a particular job for the employee. And if you look at source number 8, the reason for that is as follows. For this reason of, they are my servants and not servants to servants, applies to employee relationships. However, in contracting, the contractor isn't a servant to anyone but himself. Meaning, since when you are a contractor, your job, you're not working for them generally, but you are assigned to complete a particular task, you have the freedom to decide when you will complete that task and when you won't. You work on your own time. And as long as the time is yours, it's yours to decide what to devote to the job and what not to, and you can finish it when you get around to it, then you do not have this unique freedom afforded to workers that other workers who are do not have ownership over their time, or who have to commit to doing the job when their boss or employer wants them to. And so another consideration to take into account as to whether or not you have the right to back out of a relationship is, do you fall into the category of a poel or a koblan? Are you someone, are you committed to doing a certain job at certain times, and the time is not yours, you are on the clock? And if so, the halacha affords a greater freedom to you in concern for your welfare, or, and I think this would generally be the case with accountants and lawyers who are working for clients, you have the freedom to do the job when you want to do it. It's just that at some point the job must get done. In which case, the same freedom is not necessarily afforded to the employee. So it's interesting, halakha does seem to have a unique perspective on this relationship. We have where when people, even if they are being paid, when people do not have control of their time and would not be able to back out of relationship and would be compelled to do a job even if it was not working for them, the halakha does not want that to be the reality and therefore affords workers the unique capability to back out even after they have begun the job.
Rabbi, I just want to be clear one thing.
Yes.
We're talking about an accounting firm and a client or a law firm and a client. Jewish law does not view it as an employer-employee relationship, I take it, right? It's still going to be regarded as an independent contractor.
Right. So that would likely be a second category, right? Where you're essentially agreeing to do a job for your clients. However, it's not that they have jurisdiction over your time. You can do it when you need to. Now, it does get, without getting too bogged down this particular point, it does get a little bit complicated because often there is overlap, right? Often people who are contracted still have deadlines. And at some point, when it gets close to the deadline, they sort of are obligated to work on the clock for a very long time. They do not quite have that freedom. There is a discussion as to where do we draw the line. Is it based on whether you get paid by the hour or paid by the job, right? And again, it could be a combination. Sometimes you bill for hours, sometimes you bill for tasks. Is it based on the freedom that you have in any particular situation? Do I have the right to stop when I want to, or do I not have that right? So the question is a bit complicated. However, I think it is important to consider these factors generally in terms of the perspective on the freedom that clients and employees have. Okay. Now, another consideration which was just mentioned was before backing out of an agreement, will the agreement cause a loss to the employer or to my clients? What if my backing out will leave them in a situation where because I backed out, they either lose an opportunity or actually lose money because of my decision? So if you look at source number 10, we'll skip from number 9 for now, in the interest of time. If you look at source number 10, the Beit Yosef here again restricts the ability of an employee or of a practitioner to retract from relationship in a situation of loss. Says the Rabbi Yosef Karo, these words were only stated regarding a matter which does not result in a loss. However, regarding a matter which results in a loss, for instance, and these are particular examples of that time, if the employer was hired to remove flax from the vat. So here the case is, you have a certain amount of flax and it's soaking, and it's part of the way it's processed. If it's left there for too long of a time, the material will be ruined. And you were hired to specifically remove it from that vat, and if you don't do it, that will result in a loss of the material. So in such a case, you cannot retract. Furthermore, or he hired a donkey, or a donkey driver, to bring flutes for a funeral or wedding and the like. So what is the loss, you think, in that case? You hire someone, let's say in modern terms, you hire a band for a wedding. And now the band decides they can't make it at that time. What loss is at stake?
Happiness.
Right. Meaning?
Emotional state.
Meaning, are you going to lose money? I mean, you're not going to necessarily have to pay them. You won't lose money, but what will you lose?
Well, you might lose money if you have to hire someone else at the last minute.
That's true, and that's a good point, and we'll discuss that. But what else are you losing if they just can't make it, if you don't get anyone?
Emotional.
Right. But you need them for then. It's a time-sensitive issue. It's a time-sensitive issue. If you hire them to do a task that you need at a particular time, and now that they are backing out of the arrangement, you will not find a replacement, it's not okay to say, okay, just find someone else. Because I needed you that day, and if I don't find someone that day, you can't just do it for me tomorrow. The wedding's today. I'm going to have my wedding without a band. So what is interesting here is that a loss is not merely a financial loss, but another consideration to take into account with these types of situations is, are you putting the employer or your client in a situation where they will lose an opportunity they will not be able to make up later because of your decision? And in that case, as says Rabbi Yosef Karo, then you cannot, you do not have the right to back out. Then you should indeed finish the job. Right, exactly. Fair, fair. So then you were, yeah, exactly. Time sensitive is the issue. We will possibly discuss a difference between a case where the time sensitivity relates to an actual financial loss. So for instance, because you did not complete the job, the employer loses money, or the client actually loses money. And we could certainly think of it in cases, in you know, contemporary cases, if it's a deadline, they need to get their tax return in at that time, or if there's an investor looking for the audit at a particular time, and other cases where, although it is time sensitive, it will not actually result in a loss of money. There may still be a difference between the two, but in both cases, you are committed to fulfilling the job. So then the question becomes, given that I am now legally, quote-unquote, bound, what happens if I don't? Now, what is interesting here is that the halakha has a very interesting perspective on this. There are situations where it seems in halakha where it says you cannot renege on the agreement, and then in the next line this it says, and if you do, this is your penalty. And the question is, well, if you just said I can't, then what do you mean if you do? So on the one hand, it's very interesting that in cases of employment law, specifically in halachically, in cases of employment law, although there are cases where we say you cannot back out, an employee usually does ultimately get to back out and just suffer the consequences, as opposed to if I sell you an object and I want to back out afterward, it's not that I have to pay you or something like that. I can't back out. It is your object. And it is not mine. It doesn't matter whether I want to pay you back for it, even more money or not. Employment contracts are different. And the reason is, what exactly is the acquisition of? What are you acquiring when you make a deal with an employee or with a contractor or a professional? You're not acquiring them. You might be acquiring your time. But it's not exactly cut and dry. It's not an abstract sort of acquisition, which has a different status halachically. So while we just said that there are cases where, quote unquote, you cannot back out, ultimately you can, and you will have to pay the consequences. So yes,
the halacha puts in a provision for extraordinary circumstances or the situation that even though the halakha recognizes that a contract was made, an agreement was made, it's a reciprocal relationship, both parties are fully aware, but there's always that chance that it could be broken. Just interesting, the halakha, which is very nice, addresses that.
Yeah.
That window of opening.
Yeah, and I think, and I'm 100%, and I'm, and then I think it's also particularly interesting that it's uniquely in the realm of a relationship between people. And I think it's understandable, meaning it's one thing to sell someone an object where, okay, the object is here and I've transferred it. And either I want the object or I not, once I make that decision, okay, the decision's been made. When a person commits their time, it's not exactly the same type of situation. Things come up. And, you know, the situation is much more complex. And therefore, even in the case of a contractor, you do have the ability to back out. I think that points to what you're saying. So, generally, what are the remedies for breach of contract in secular law? So, it should be noted that most of the time there will be a provision in the contract where you say we can back out at any time, or the employee can back out at any time, or or we can fire you at any time. So often breach of contract won't necessarily be the particular discussion at hand. However, I believe that there is still a question of negligence. Meaning, if you write that in the contract, if you're negligent in the way that you went about severing the relationship without due cause or without warning, I do believe that you still may be subject to penalties for doing so. So if you look at source number 11, from Henry Mather, from the Yale Law Journal, he says as follows: the alternative remedies are damages and specific performance. The purposes of damage, the purpose of damage is to put the plaintiff in a position economically equivalent to the position he would have held if the contract had been performed. So one type of remedy for someone who has the party which had a contract breached and was not guilty of the breach is that they are entitled to damages. They get paid money to restore the position that they lost as a result of the breach of contract. The other alternative is specific performance. The purpose, if you look at the second line in source 11, the purpose of specific performance is to approximate the effects of voluntary performance by compelling the defendant to render as nearly as practicable the very performance she promised. Meaning, we make them do it anyway. That sometimes, and I'm told it's more rare, but sometimes the remedy is that the court will require the party which breached the contract to do what they committed to doing, even though they don't want to. We make you do the job, even if you say, I don't want to do it anymore. Now the question is, which of these is preferable? Which would you say is a better remedy? Awarding money and damages to the party who suffered a breach of contract, or requiring the other party to actually finish the job?
Money, because the person won't do the job like as professionally as he could. He's angry.
Okay, that's fair. So practically, you're saying they don't want to actually do a good job.
They haven't done the job.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
But requiring the person to complete the job will set a clear, distinct precedent for the future that there is that understanding that once you start with a client, you need to finish with the client.
Fair. You could always just do it. Fair. What about in terms of fairness? In terms of, well, the punishment matching the crime. Which would you say? Which remedy more directly addresses the breach, the actual problem with what their behavior was? Right. So I would have thought, it's interesting, I would have thought, look, if what you did wrong was you decided not to do a job, the perfect way to solve that is to make the men do the job. That's what they did wrong. Now you're arguing they're not going to do a good job of it, and that's a fair argument. But so what do we have in halacha? So it's interesting. There's a question as to whether or not the halacha will ever require specific performance in an employee relationship. So regarding a what we call a po'el, a worker, someone who works hours in a particular amount of time and is not a contractor, there everybody will agree that you never can specifically require them to finish their job. That is the freedom afforded to a worker. What about a contractor? If you look at source number 12, the source says as follows. Some say that if a contractor commits through an acquisition, the employer can force him to finish the job. Meaning, once that act of acquisition has been made, a contract has been signed, the handkerchief has been handed over, once all those things have been done, you can make the contractor do it. You can make them finish that tax return. You can make them finish the audit. Okay. See, thank you. Thank you for taking the... Yeah.
That may be, you can make them finish the audit, but the audit may not be a clean opinion or anything
else. That's a fair point. That's 100% a fair point.
It may be we finish it and it's not what the person expected. So,
in fact, it could be very detrimental.
Yes, in fact, it could be very detrimental. So I don't see where this
lands. So we're at source number 12. So specific performance is a discussion in halacha as to whether or not we will require it. Some say you can. What's interesting is you look at source number 13, for reasons of time, we'll discuss it outside. The halacha sometimes requires damages, but the damages are really there to actually ensure that the job indeed can get done. So you look at source number 13, and this is from the Aruch HaShulchan, Rechiel Michal Epstein, suggests as follows. He says that the Gemara says that if indeed it is a situation of loss, and because of the employee backing out of the relationship, the employer or the client will lose out. The employer or client has two different remedies. One is he can do what we call socher alehen, which means he can hire replacement workers, and any additional expense that he has to pay to those second group of workers is on the account of the first workers up to the salary that they agreed upon. So if I hired accounting firm A for, let's just say, arguably $10,000 to complete the job, they backed out, my financial statements have not been processed, now I need to get somebody else to do the job, and let's say it will cost more money, I can use their $10,000 I would have paid them, and they have to pay that, and add that to whatever I would need to pay the second accounting firm. So again, money is awarded, but the purpose of it is to ensure that the job ends up getting done. Additionally, another remedy that the employers have is what we call mita'an, which means you can deceive them. You have the right to promise the employees or clients, the employees or practitioners who decided to end the relationship, you get to bribe them with more money and say, I will pay you a lot more money. And at the end of the day, you have the right to actually only pay them the originally agreed upon amount. You can trick them into getting back into it. And that's what serves them right for backing out unnecessarily when it would have caused you a loss. So on the one hand, it's very interesting that the halacha allows you essentially to lie and trick them in order to get them to finish the job. At the same time, it doesn't just say, well, they have to do the job, right? You have to end up getting them to finish it, or get others to finish it. It's a bit unclear halachically, what if you don't do this? There are different opinions. Let's say I don't get someone to finish the job. Do I have the right to charge the original employees the loss that I suffer as a result? Many commentators say that you indeed do. And both. In the event that you lose money, let's say you get a penalty for not filing your taxes in an efficient way, you can charge them that, some would argue. And this discussion is only in a case where it wouldn't actually cause you money. Meaning everybody will agree for no actual financial losses incurred, then you have this recourse. You can get them to finish the job or get others to finish the job on their account. In a case where you actually lose money as a result of their negligence in severing the relationship, and again, I should mention, in a case where they're compelled to, the Shulchan Aruch mentions, in a case where they're compelled to because they lose a relative or they get sick or something like that, then they have the right to then back out and they will not lose money as a result. But if they were negligent in doing so then you have the right to financial reimbursement if you actually lost money and not just an opportunity. So, just so if you look at source number 14 and 15, I think it's actually very interesting. In source number 14, Rabbi Yontov ben Avram Ashaveli, the Ritva, argues that the basis, the reasoning behind this idea is as follows. When you make commitments to somebody and they rely on you, and if it had not been for your negligence, they would not have lost money, that in and of itself is binding in halacha. Our commitments are binding in cases where they're relied upon and cause a loss. And when you make a commitment to someone and they're relying on you and putting their money at stake, the halacha takes that very seriously and will charge you for being negligent in that case, and even in a case where you don't make a formal act of acquisition. Even a verbal commitment which results in a reliance and a loss of money and is binding. What is interesting is you look at source number 15 by Stephen A. Smith, not to be confused with the basketball analyst. For those who follow, he argues that the reason that often we don't resort to specific performance and we instead resort to actual payments is that the theory what he calls efficient breach, that there are times where it makes sense for people to back out of a relationship because it's just not worth it for you anymore. And therefore, sometimes the law will encourage you to do so and suffer the financial consequences rather than simply finishing the job because it makes sense for you to. And he argues if it was really rights-based, meaning that when you make a commitment, you should honor your commitment, it would make much more sense to require specific performance because that's what you committed to. However, you see from the Ritva that it's not necessarily so, that we see halakhically, even if we don't require literal specific performance, we do allow you to pay to make sure the job gets done or lie to do so. And also that a rights-based, even a rights-based theory can result in financial commitments. Because you committed to me and what you did was wrong, you have to pay for that. And I think that leads us to the other consideration that beyond our responsibilities to our clients and to our employers, there is a responsibility to God, the religious responsibility that... Was that?
No, I was going to say that, like with Yom Kippur and saying and having a vow, where it's like you make yourself obligated, you've obligated yourself to somebody and you're Jewish and you know you've made a promise, you have to follow through with it. Now, there are extenuating circumstances. Somebody gets sick, somebody passes away, whatever. But besides that, it's like a vow. It's sacred. It's important.
100%.
You have to follow through on your word.
100%. That there is a requirement, even if not in a financial sense, but in a religious sense, in an ethical sense, to commit to your word, even if there are no financial repercussions of not doing so. If you take a look at source number 16 and 17, you can look at the English. We'll just mention them outside. Even though halachically, a verbal acquisition or a verbal commitment is not bonding financially, it is looked on very unfavorably to back out of a verbal agreement. It says the sages are displeased with you. There are even sources where we have the right to call you wicked for doing so. Public shaming for someone who backs out of a verbal commitment. Yes?
Isn't it deraita?
To what?
Could it shame you?
Yes, it is deraita. You just might not be compelled financially to finish it, but 100%. And there are many verses we can quote from the Bible which discuss the importance of keeping one's word. If you look at source number 18, there the Mishnah discusses a case where someone agreed to, a sharecropper agrees to plant their friend's field. It says that one opinion is that if you agree to plant wheat in their field, you can still plant barley. Why? I mean, I can't attest to the accuracy of the statement, but barley is more beneficial to the land. Wheat apparently damages the land, so even though they told you to plant wheat, you have the right, according to one opinion, to plant barley. But Rav Shmuel Gamliel says you cannot do that. Why? Because you committed to doing the job of planting wheat. And even though it's more beneficial for them for you to do something else, you have to honor your commitment. He quotes the verse, Sheirit Yisrael Yasu Avla, that it's wrong to be deceitful and to speak lies and iniquity. We don't do such things. It's not becoming of a moral individual. And if you look at source number 19, it says, the Gemara says, quoting a pasuk, a comment of Moses, and he performs what is straight in his eyes and the eyes of God. This refers to business. For anyone who does business with loyalty and who's pleasant to others, the verse considers it as if he had fulfilled the entire Torah. This idea of doing business with loyalty, committing to your word, keeping your word, honoring relationships, is a religious requirement, and it's something that ultimately, if we can't trust each other's words, then what will be with our social relationships? What do you have to rely on someone else if they're just going to back out of their commitments? So, in conclusion, when we think about severing client relationships, certainly one should think about their respect, the repercussions to themselves. There's another consideration to the public, and are people relying on your work? There is the consideration to the client and how you are inconveniencing them or potentially causing them a loss. And finally, and maybe even most importantly, is your values as a person, as being an ethical, honest person and being someone who commits to the decisions that you make. Thank you very much.
One question.
Yes.